Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, what might lie ahead for investors after Greece says no to a bailout? Considering the issues that need to be resolved at the Iran nuclear talks, a beloved comedy puppet team is returning.
The Muppets are silliness and love, all wrapped up in his music and very, very colorful personalities.
And looking back at the short life of singer Amy Winehouse, coming up right here on The Voice of America. Greece faces an uncertain future after more than 60% of Greeks voted no this weekend to new austerity measures in exchange for more bailout funds. VOA's Alexis Christophorus joins us on the line for a look at what investors can expect this week. Alexis.
Susan, the no vote sets up a showdown with Greece and its creditors this week. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is meeting with her French counterpart today. That's ahead of an emergency summit of Eurozone leaders scheduled for Tuesday. Meantime, the European Central Bank's Governing Council is meeting today, and they're discussing whether to keep the emergency funding lines open for Greek banks. Without this new aid, banks in Greece will quickly run out of cash, and the country could be forced to exit the Eurozone. Banks continue to be closed in Greece, as does the stock exchange there, for fear that there may be a run on the banks. Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis abruptly resigned. Varoufakis actually supported a no vote, so his resignation came as a surprise to Europe. He said he would step down to help the Greek government secure a deal with creditors, and he added that he will wear the creditors' loathing with pride. That's a direct quote. He was sort of seen as a poster child of all things that were wrong with the Greek economy. And so at least the stock markets around the world see his resignation as a positive, because they believe that with him, with someone new in that position, that they hold out greater hope for some sort of a deal to be reached with creditors.
Well, how have the global markets reacted to this historic vote in Greece?
Well, you can imagine that the reaction was swift. The euro fell about 0.5%. It dropped below $1.10 before rebounding, and that happened after Greece's finance minister announced his resignation. We saw bonds in Spain and Italy decline because, again, there's fear there that those countries' economies are not very strong, and that if Greece were to indeed leave the eurozone, that Spain and Italy may be next in line to do the same. Stocks in Europe and the U.S. Are lower, but really, the sell-off is not nearly as severe as we saw a week ago when Greece first announced this surprise referendum. And in fact, U.S. stocks are almost near the flat line at the moment.
Well, how likely is it that we will see Greece exit the eurozone?
Well, you can imagine a lot of people are weighing in on this, and we actually are now hearing from some Wall Street firms. And Morgan Stanley says there is now a 75% chance Greece will leave the eurozone. That's up from 60% last week. SocGen put it at 65%, and BNP Paribas increased the probability of an exit to 70%, and that is up from just 20% a week ago. So the feeling here is that that no vote does mean that Greece is pushing itself further toward bankruptcy and an exit from the eurozone. And we've talked about Greece being a small economy. Despite that, if it were to leave the eurozone, analysts agree it would absolutely disrupt the single currency euro, and it would spread fear that an exit is really a precedent for other struggling economies like Italy, like Spain, and Portugal to follow suit.
I have a feeling we're going to be talking about this for a long time.
You bet. I have the same feeling.
Okay. Well, thank you, Alexis, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Let's have a look at what social media are saying about the Greek crisis today. Michael Lippin has joined me here in the studio to give us an update. Michael.
Hello, Susan. Well, I can tell you that on Twitter, the most popular hashtags to tweet about the situation in Greece are hashtag Greferendum and hashtag Greece. Both of those have been used more than 150,000 times in the last 24 hours. That's according to the Top C Analytics website. And one of the highest profile Twitter users in Greece today is the outgoing finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, who sent out this tweet early Monday, "Minister no more!" Exclamation mark. So, you know, it looks like he's not that sad to be leaving his position.
Yeah, it sounds like he's enjoying it.
Maybe even enjoying it, true. And he also added a link to his latest blog post in which he elaborates about his decision to quit. In that blog post, this is what Varoufakis said. He said that soon after the announcement of the referendum results, he was made aware of a preference by some Eurozone group participants, he didn't name names, for him to be absent from future meetings about Greece. And then Varoufakis said that Greek Prime Minister Tsipras considered that preference for his absence to be helpful in reaching an agreement on resolving the Greek crisis. And then Varoufakis added, "For this reason, I am leaving the finance ministry today."
What do we know about who will replace him?
Well, Mina, multiple media outlets are quoting sources in the Greek presidency as saying the new finance minister will be Euclid Tsakalotos, and that he is a Greek official who has been coordinating Greece's economic negotiations with Europe since April. Now, Tsakalotos does have his own Twitter handle, at Tsakalotos, with 12,000 followers. That will probably go up now. But he hasn't been tweeting very much in English lately. But I've already found some information on Twitter about the expected new Greek finance minister. And that information included a link to a profile of Tsakalotos in British newspaper The Guardian. The article says Tsakalotos is a leftist whose views were shaped at Oxford University, where he belonged to the student wing of Greece's Communist Party. Susan?
Well, thank you, Michael.
Sure.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
When someone dies, one of the key questions medical examiners or forensics experts try to answer is the exact time of death. Sometimes the examiners, especially those involved in criminal investigation, need to determine the time of death of someone who has been deceased for a while. Unfortunately, current technology really doesn't provide any reliable way of determining time of death if the person has been dead for more than 36 hours. But a group of researchers at Austria's University of Salzburg say that they've developed a new method for calculating this, even if the subject has been dead for as long as 10 days. To develop the new calculation, the researchers studied dead pigs and observed how much muscle proteins and enzymes decomposed over a period of time. They found that some of the proteins showed no signs of degradation until after 10 days. By studying the appearance of these signs, the researchers were able to determine the exact time of death. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The nuclear negotiations in Vienna between Iran and the five permanent Security Council members plus Germany continue. There's an effort being made to try to finish by Thursday, July the 11th. VOA's Jeffrey Young has been following the Iran nuclear talks and joins me here in the studio. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi, Susan. I spoke with research analyst Timothy Stafford at the Royal United Services Institute in London. Tim sets forth the things that are right now keeping the two sides from forging an agreement.
So the number of sticking points, but the two major ones are going to be, firstly, the intrusiveness of the inspections that are going to be conducted by the IAEA monitors if a deal is reached. The P5 plus one would like monitors in all of Iran's nuclear sites. They'd like continuous access. But most importantly of all, they want access to Iranian nuclear scientists and to Iran's military sites. Now, Iran is very resistant to this, partly because it sees it as a violation of its sovereignty, and also it's worried what those inspectors are going to find, particularly maybe some of its past weaponization activity. The second question is going to be the phasing of the sanctions relief. The Iranians would like sanctions relief straight away. The Western powers say no, this has to come over a matter of months and years as Iran complies to the deal and to its terms.
The French Foreign Minister, Laurent Fabius, said, "These negotiations began 12 years ago, and now we are 72 hours away from the moment when they should conclude." Now, he was speaking apparently of Thursday, July the 11th. Why is this important, 72 hours?
So it's an interesting comment by the French foreign minister. Originally, the deadline that the parties had set for themselves was the 30th of June, and then there was another one-week delay to get us to the 7th. Now, the key date, as analysts had always understood it, was that it was going to be July 9th. Because Congress has already passed legislation which will grant it 30 days to review the deal before signing off on it. If a deal isn't struck by July 9th, then that deadline will run into a time when Congress is away on its recess, and therefore it'll take another 60 days. And the longer the time between between a deal being signed and a deal being ratified by Congress, the more likely it is that opposition has a chance to mount. So it's a very interesting comment by the French foreign minister to suggest that another 72 hours from where we are now is going to be needed. That implies, actually, as far as I consider the situation, that things are not going as well as the P5 plus one would have hoped. They'd have wanted a deal much earlier than then.
What are the major sticking points regarding the quantity of that stockpile, the enrichment level of that stockpile, and its ultimate disposition? Do we have an issue here?
So there is an issue here. The administration's position has always been that Iran only wants a civilian nuclear program, and if you call Tehran's bluff by allowing it a civilian nuclear program, then once it has what it wants, then it will become less antagonistic, that you can make a concession in that area and then force Iran to prove that it doesn't want anything more like a nuclear weapons program. The problem here is that the deal puts limitations on the number of centrifuges that Iran will maintain for the next 10 to 15 years, the amount of enriched uranium it's allowed to possess for the next 10 to 15 years. The question at issue is Iran going to be allowed to conduct research and development on very advanced centrifuges so that in 15 years' time, when the deal expires, it could get to a weapons capability very quickly? So there seems to be some basic agreement on numbers and on quantity of enriched material, but not on what Iran is allowed to develop over the next 10 to 15 years.
Jeffrey, did you get the sense that these issues are going to be resolved soon?
Oh, Susan, right now, nothing is easy to predict. These inspections and other matters are huge, and until they get resolved fairly on both sides, we're not going to see an agreement.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
The Muppets, those adorable puppets, are coming back to television on ABC this fall. They've made their way into people's hearts also on the big screen. Cartoonist Guy Gilchrist worked with puppet creator Jim Henson and joins us now on the line. Welcome, Guy.
It's great to be with you.
Thank you. Nice to have you. Why do kids and adults alike so enjoy The Muppets?
You know, The Muppets are silliness and love, all wrapped up in music and very, very colorful personalities. You know, getting to work with Jim was one of the greatest moments of my life, certainly changed my life. But before I worked for Jim, I was about the biggest Muppet fan there was in the world. And so you can imagine what it was like, you know, to eventually get to work with him and work right beside him. But, you know, when you create characters of a nature that are so universal, you look at all of the emotions that those characters all represent. This is stuff that never, ever ages. And, Jim was very, very, always very, very conscious, too, about making sure that the humor would be timeless and also universal, that the characters wouldn't be American, but they would belong to the world.
Well, the characters have evolved over the years. When they started out, they were pretty simple and pure.
Yeah, well, Jim was really an innovator, you know. But he started off in the late 50s in the Washington, D.C. area doing a five-minute show between the end of the news and the Tonight Show called Sam and Friends. That was local right in Washington, D.C. And at that time, you know, the puppets were simple hand puppets. But over the years, and my gosh, I got to see this, you know, on a daily basis, Jim would come up with new technology where the characters could, you know, walk on their own. They had electronics in them, all sorts of different things to just keep moving the art form forward.
Can you give me an example of that?
Yeah, I remember one night Jim and I were having dinner at Maxwell's Plum in Central Park in New York City, and he was just back from working on The Great Muppet Caper. And if you remember in The Great Muppet Caper, there was a wonderful, wonderful scene where all of the characters are riding bikes, and you can see the choreography of the bikes, an aerial shot, in all kinds of different shots. And Jim took great delight that night in taking all the butter patties and the teacups and the salt and pepper shakers and moving them all around the table to illustrate how he did that and orchestrated that. And, oh, my gosh, I was laughing, and he was having so much fun explaining how the magic was being done.
He was a wonderful man. Well, what can we expect from the new TV show?
I think you're going to get I think what we're going to see is the Muppets parodying the documentary and the reality show in pretty much exactly the same way that Jim and the Muppets parodied everything. Remember Veterinarian's Hospital, you know, that was, of course, a parody of General Hospital, and Pigs in Space. Who can't?
Yes, Pigs in Space.
The Muppets have always parodied everything. I'm kind of wondering if Miss Piggy's not going to be, like, you know, on The Bachelorette or something.
Oh.
what would that be, the Baconette?
No.
Oh, I don't know. Sorry.
No.
But I'm really not, because I work for the Muppets, so, you know, puns are us.
Well, thank you so much, Guy, for chatting with us today.
Oh, it's been wonderful being with you, and I'll see you in the funny papers.
You're tuned to VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
British singer Amy Winehouse spanned less than a decade, and with her untimely death was seemingly over in the blink of an eye. Her entire life is chronicled in a new documentary film, as we hear from VOA's David Byrd, who gets things started with a Winehouse tune.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no.
Amy Winehouse died 4 years ago this month, but the new documentary Amy, by award-winning director Asif Kapadia, takes audiences behind the tragic story to meet the real Amy Winehouse. As he did with the acclaimed documentary Senna about the late Formula One champion Ayrton Senna, Kapadia uses no narration, only the words of the singer, her family, her friends, and those around her. Home videos, news reports, and performances show the singer from her childhood until her death at age 27.
I'm not a girl trying to be a star or trying to be anything other than a musician.
How big do you think you're going to be?
I don't think I'm going to be at all famous. I don't think I could handle it. I would probably go mad, you know what I mean? I would go mad.
Kapadia says the interviews with those around Winehouse paint a picture of a girl who loved making music, but was also deeply troubled.
I hope people will see the real Amy, as all of her friends called her, young Amy, really funny, really intelligent, bright-eyed, really beautiful and happy, amazingly creative. And then also, as the story gets darker, I hope people will kind of think about, you know, what happened and how it happened, and maybe a little bit about how I think everyone was slightly complicit.
Producer James Gay Reese says that as he and Kapadia researched the story, they began to unravel all the forces that tugged at Winehouse, and he thinks their portrayal of her shows the real woman.
And a lot of people who are very close to her say, you know, we have managed to kind of nail the real her. And that's the most important thing, is that people remember her for the lovely, brilliant person that she was, because she wasn't just some cartoon character that could be vilified in the press. And hopefully, I think what's happening is a lot of people are re-evaluating her. And, you know, because we don't, people like her don't come around very often, and we need to look after them.
Several people featured in the film attended its premiere, including Winehouse's former manager, Nick Szymanski, who said the movie shows the singer's extraordinary talent.
She was able to kind of sing jazz, sing R&Bs, have a killer voice, but she also had like a really modern perspective on stuff. And lyrically, she was as witty and as sharp as the best hip-hop rappers, you know, in terms of her writing and her lyrical ability.
Her parents' divorce when Amy was 9 is cited as a turning point in her life. Winehouse's family, particularly her father Mitch, has criticized the film for being inaccurate.
And I'm not just fighting for me, I'm fighting for Amy, because this is not the film that Amy would have wanted. You know, she would want her true friends to be recognized, which they're not. She'd want the man that she was going to be married to be mentioned in the film, which he's not. She'd want me not to be portrayed in this light, because she knows what we all went through.
Asif Kapadia says that he has heard the family's criticism, but in the end, the film is not about them. It's about Amy.
No, you can't keep everybody happy. But what I will say is the vast majority of people who knew her well, who've seen the movie, really like it. And quite frankly, the movie's not about Reg, it's not about Mitch, it's about Amy. And I deny anybody to tell me that she doesn't come out of the movie brilliantly, because she does. She comes out of it fantastically. And it's a much more organic whole representation of who she was.
Amy is rated R for language and drug material. I'm David Byrd.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you'd like to listen to today's program again, visit our website, voanews.com. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In testimony before Congress regarding the state of democracy in Asia, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Tom Malinowski and Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Scott Marciel spoke of the crucial importance of promoting democracy and human rights. Helping to further democratic governance is not only the right thing to do, said Assistant Secretary of State Malinowski, it also advances our strategic interest by building more stable societies. And, most importantly, it aligns the United States with the aspirations of everyday people across this region. Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Marciel highlighted U.S. efforts to promote democracy in 3 very different places, Cambodia, Thailand, and Hong Kong. After the 2013 parliamentary election in Cambodia, the United States, particularly through its embassy in Phnom Penh, worked to help bring the government and opposition together in direct dialogue to resolve a year-long standoff. Much work still remains, but now the two sides sit in parliament together, said Mr. Marciel. Regarding Cambodia's civil society, the United States is connecting directly with a new generation of leaders and standing with Cambodians who are pushing for a voice as new laws are drafted. This, he said, sends a reminder that democracy isn't only about free elections, it's also about citizens' ability to hold their governments accountable. Thailand has long been a friend and ally, and the United States has stood for democracy there through a decade of political turmoil. Our message to the government since the 2014 coup, said Mr. Marciel, is that our bilateral relationship can be restored to its fullest only when democracy is reestablished. It is critical for Thailand to have an inclusive political process and to fully restore civil liberties. Regarding Hong Kong, the United States has consistently voiced its core belief that an open society respecting the rights of its citizens is essential to Hong Kong's continued stability and prosperity. With respect to electoral reform, Mr. Marciel noted that the United States continues to affirm its long-standing position that the legitimacy of the chief executive and of Hong Kong's overall governance can be enhanced through a competitive election that features a meaningful choice of candidates who represent the will of the voters. The work to promote good governance is never complete, but the United States will continue to support efforts to build and strengthen democracy in Asia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.